Okay, thanks. It's always nice to be back here. Every time the place is even better. So I'll talk about this effective filter Lasche structure, which to me is the way to go for the early universe. So this talk is about what I think is a nice effective field theory. You'll see some general relativity, and also you will see some energy techniques applies to a novel setting, which is a Lasche structure of the universe. But what is really this talk about, I think, at least to me, is that the near future for early universe cosmology, I think, stands on this program. So as I'm now going to argue. Now, the early observables we are testing from the background, how do we probe the early universe? Now, the early observable we're testing about the background cosmology is the curvature, which we then detect. It's just bounded like this. All the rest comes from the fluctuation. This is Planck power spectra, which we know that primordial because there are baryon acoustic oscillations. They ask an invariant with a small tilt. It's approximately Gaussian. The skewness is limited to less than 10 to the minus 3. And then there are both scalar and tensor modes, maybe. Tensor modes, we know, maybe. So all this information comes from the fluctuation. And in fact, what we're really testing about the early universe, about inflation, is the theory of the fluctuations, which can be represented by this Lagrangian called the effective theory of inflation. And in fact, I think a very nice way that we did with Kendrick to map the cosmological information into fundamental physics information is to derive constraints for this Lagrangian from data. And for example, these are the counter plots of the parameters of the Lagrangian, CS, for example, and this other parameter A. You get this counter plot, which are really synthesized, condensing what we know from cosmological observation about the fundamental Lagrangian of the early universe. So detection, non-detection of non-Gaussianities or anything else represent constraints or measurement of the parameter of this Lagrangian. Notice that non-Gaussianities, which are non-Gaussianities sounds like a fancy word, but it's just the interaction, the interactive structure of the theory. So beyond the field theory, it's all what there is, are controlled by dimension 6 operator. So detection, non-detection, non-Gaussianities is a constraint or a measurement of the scales suppressing these operators. Now, since non-Gaussianities are controlled by dimension, or the interaction structure of the Lagrangian is controlled by dimension 6 operator, their importance goes like h square over lambda square, where Hubble is the energy scale that we probe during inflation, and lambda is this energy scale that we don't know about. So the importance of this operator scales as the ratio of these two energies. Now, given that in WMAP we didn't detect non-Gaussianities, we had a minimum level of lambda, which was lambda minimum from WMAP. When we went to Planck, we didn't detect non-Gaussianities, but Planck improved this constraint by a factor of about 3. So the minimum scales that we know that is from Planck is about 2, actually, square root of 3, larger than the one we knew was the lower limit from WMAP. Now, this is not a great improvement, given that we didn't have any threshold, any specific value of this lambda unitarity bound of this dimension 6 operator. It was just a scale, not constrained by any theoretical prejudice. So if you have a scale that you don't know what it's about, and you change the scale by a factor of 2, you're not learning a lot. So this means that Planck was a nice experiment, but Planck was really not good enough. And it's not Planck's fault, it's nature's fault. That is, Planck measures all the CMB, all the modes available to us in the CMB by nature, but there were not enough modes to significantly improve what we already knew from WMAP. So Planck was really an opportunity for a detection, not much an opportunity to change the theory in absence of detection. For example, with WMAP, we were lucky and we got 2.5 sigma detection of the tilt with WMAP. And so a factor of 3 here makes this a 6 sigma. So Planck can say we detected the tilt. But this is because there was already something in WMAP. Instead, if you don't have any detection in WMAP and Planck still doesn't get detection, it's not great. It doesn't change anything. This is very different than what happens. In particle physics. For example, take LHC. LHC was an experiment designed to cross a very important theoretical threshold, which is the unitarity bound of WW scattering. So the Higgs was the guaranteed discovery or violation of quantum mechanics. And even more importantly, it was going to such high energies that if you don't see anything beyond the Higgs, you have to rethink about naturalness, the deep principle of quantum field theory. So any result from LHC, even a non-discovery, was teaching us something. Planck is not the case, because it's not crossing any theoretical threshold.
Is it a bit late to talk about this?
But I'm going to provide you. Okay. I'm going to provide you now. So I'm building up. So in cosmology is going to change radically in a few months, because tremendous progress has been made in the last 20 years through observation of the primordial fluctuations. In order to increase our knowledge of inflation, we need more modes. And Planck will soon have observed basically all the CMB available modes. And then what we do after Planck? If you assume that we are not lucky, and let me assume I'm not lucky, so we don't have any B-mode detection, we don't know signs of something that happens before inflation, nothing that we're not guaranteed to add. Now we're analyzing the four-point function with Kendrick, so let's assume that this afternoon we don't get a detection of four-point function. So suppose we are not lucky, unless we find a way to get more mode, the game is over. Cosmology, as in the last 20 years, is over. We don't learn any more about the primordial universe. Yes, but there is no guaranteed detection test. So that is, even tensor mode, actually, I think, fall in this category. This is, if we're lucky, we detect them, we learn a lot. But if we don't detect, so it is, suppose R is not there, and we improve the limit to 10 to the minus 3, okay? Our knowledge of inflation, the energy scale of inflation changes by the fourth root of 3. Say you don't get any detection until R 10 to the minus 3, the energy scale of inflation is not changed much. Now, we learned that the field wasn't Trans-Planckian. That's interesting, but okay, yeah. The field rate, we will learn, if you put the constraints on R below 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 2, we know that the field discussion was less than Planck. This is good, but it's not something that keeps me deeply satisfied. It's good, but. So instead, what's happening is that large-scale structure surveys are experiments that are happening in the medium term, for sure, and is the right place to hunt for more modes. But therefore, if you want to have these more modes, we need to understand large-scale structure. And I don't think that so far we understand them well enough. In fact, mentions like Euclid and LSST are already financed, and they will explore the large-scale structure of the universe with great accuracy. So therefore, we need to understand how many of these modes that they will measure are available for cosmology. Since the number of modes goes like a max cube over k-mean cube, k-mean is dictated by the size of the surveys, and I can do nothing about that. But k-max is the shortest word number of the surveys, and is limited not by their resolution, but of how much we understand the physics at short distances. So if you understand a lot the physics, we can push this k-max high, and therefore we gain like the cubic of how much we push it. So this means that we need to understand how many modes are available, we need to understand the short distance physics. And this is similar as when particle physics passed from an electronic collider to an hadronic collider. An electronic collider is much cleaner, but it's much less powerful. LSC is much more powerful, but you need to understand QCD. Large-scale structure surveys are a bit like QCD. They're a bit dirty, but if you understand them, they can deliver a lot.
So, question, but I mean, Mathez's analogy is that you had a target for LHC that was discovered on Higgs, and that just the quantum mechanics was fair if you didn't.
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think there is always something good when you improve things by orders of magnitude. So what I'm going to argue is that the constraints of FNL with large structure, with the effect of large structure, we can gain a factor of 2. I mean, we can gain more than one order of magnitude, one to orders of magnitude improvement in FNL, equilateral, for example.
But if you do that and you don't see anything,
I think when you change scales by orders of magnitude, not by square root of 3, by orders of magnitude, that's good. I mean, that's really a threshold, because an order of magnitude is a threshold. On top of that, you can argue, but I can explain you later, I mean, it takes some time, that non-detection or non-Gaussianities up to FNL of order 1, it's a theoretical proof of slow-run inflation. So this large structure survey can reach you FNL at 1/2. I mean, seems that you can get these kind of numbers, FNL 1, and then this is a theoretical threshold we will cross. Thanks. So in order to understand this mode, I started this program and spent a lot of time developing called effective theory of large structure. These are some references. But the idea is to understand large structure. This is well-defined perturbation theory to predict how large structure work. And the idea is that if you look at the function of scale, the overdensity of the universe, at long distances, in Fourier space, long distances, the perturbations are small, and then they become larger at short distances. In fact, at long distances, the universe is quite homogeneous, delta rho over rho is small. As we go to shorter distances, we get the galaxies. So it's very tempting to develop a perturbation theory expanding delta rho over rho that describes the theory correctly in the infrared and going as much as possible in the ultraviolet. Now, all current available technique that try to do this are to me, but I think beyond to me, not well defined. Now, the standard way people try to address this problem is to assume that the dark matter, the large structure of the universe on long distances, were approximated by a pressureless perfect fluid. And for example, this is the continuity equation. And then they try to solve this equation by expanding and iterating in delta rho over rho, which on long distances is very small. So delta rho over rho, you see that this is a nonlinear equation because in the absolute V is proportional to delta rho over rho, because if the universe is homogeneous, there is no V. So you solve iteratively this equation, and the general structure of the solution is that the nth order solution will be some green function applied to the lower to the some source evaluated on the lower order solutions, and you crank up the wheel. Then you can take expectation values of these nth order solutions. And for example, when you take the second order solution wedged with the second order solution, you'll get squares of first order solutions contracted. And then you can see that if you want to have a long mode fluctuations in the external legs, you can have arbitrarily high Schur wavelet modes in the convolution integral because the product of two Schur modes can give a long mode. If you take a Schur modes and minus the Schur modes, the total wave number is zero. So this is the fact that very short distance physics affect long distance physics. In fact, this convolution integral can be represented as loops. Loops has nothing to do with quantum field theory. They're just a way to solve a field theory, which is a continuum theory. You get loops, and as we know from quantum field theory, but it has nothing with quantum mechanics. It's all about translation invariance, how Fourier modes sum up. Two high mode can give to a low mode. So the loops runs arbitrarily high in the wave number. And but when we go very high in the wave number, we cannot trust anymore this loop because we expanded this equation in delta rho over rho, which is k over k nonlinear, but this becomes bigger than one at some point. So what are we doing when we solve the Taylor expansion? Also, this equation is some kind of an assumption full equation. We're saying that dark matter is a perfect fluid, but dark matter are really particles crossing each other. But on very short distances, it cannot be described by a fluid. So even the equation that we're trying to solve, even if we're able to solve them exactly, clearly they're not the right equation because on short distances, the dark matter is not a perfect fluid. So this tells us that all what was done so far is ill-defined, so it should not have worked. In fact, it didn't work. So let me instead give you an idea of the effective theory that instead I think is well-defined. And the idea is very simple. In fact, you have to remember when you studied the electric materials in undergraduate. Now, the electric materials are very complicated on atomic distance scales. But if you focus on long distances much longer than the atomic distance, we can describe atoms with their gross characteristics. For example, of all these atoms with just some dipole, we are satisfied with the induced dipole by the electric field. And we think about the polarization of the material as the average induced electric dipole. This is the average response to the electric field, the dipole induced in a long wavelength electric field. So after doing all the machinery of dipole materials, what we are left to solve is this, we solve Maxwell equations in a smooth uniform material with just some macroscopic property like the electric electric constants. We simply solve this. We do not solve vacuum Maxwell equation with 10 to the 20 atoms. We solve a much simpler problem. Now, the dielectric materials can be thought as the defective theory of compact objects that are affected by long distance force, which is called electromagnetism, and they're affected by the electric force and they back react to the electric force inducing inducing electricity, in a universe with two long-range forces, electromagnetism and gravity. So it's natural to wonder what happens if the long force is gravity. Are there objects that are like atoms for the electric field? And the objects are galaxies. Galaxies are objects that are affected by gravity. They shrink, they collapse, but also degenerate gravity itself. In fact, so if you substitute the atoms with the galaxies, you get, and electromagnetism with generativity, you get the universe. So the effective theory of the universe is really the analogous of the effective theory for the electric materials. So this is the idea, and now we're going to study it more in detail. But let me just tell you the result.
Can I?
Yes, yeah.
So the difference is that you could do this, like for optical light, you could do this because the wavelength is much bigger than the distance between atoms. But if you do X-rays, you cannot actually use it in the electric description. You could, like, Bragg is scattering and the crystal structure enters.
Sorry, I got distracted. Can you repeat?
My point is that you can do use the dielectric approximation if the wavelength of the light is much longer than the distance between atoms. So then there's
yes.
coherent.
Yeah.
But if the wavelength become comparable to the size, like for X-rays, then you don't use the dielectric approximation. You have to
Exactly. So this is, in fact, the electric material are an expansion in wavelength of light,
right.
or wavelength, if you want, of observation, over wavelength of, over wavelength of the electric material, over the atomic size.
Right.
In the universe, we have the same. The expansion will be the mode you are interested in over the mode corresponding to the linear scale. This will be our expansion parameter. The size of the object over the size we care of. Okay, I think this is getting harder now. Yes, but this is not my laptop because my laptop wasn't working. I have a small... I think so. Ah, you have a charger? Okay, yes, we have a charger.
No, that's the power here. It's not the power.
Okay,
but I think it's just the shutdown. It's just that it automatically shuts down when. Thanks.
Is the connection itself having trouble?
It's a fact that I think if it's not connected to the power, it goes to sleep every 1 minute. I don't know. You see what? Okay, I think Hendrik went to take it. So.
Alright. So.
What happened now?
I just did it two screens.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay, so this is the expansion. But before I explain in detail how this effective theory is constructed. Let me give you the main result. So what we achieve with this effective theory, this is the current result of this effective theory evaluated some order called two loop with infrared resonant mesh. This is the most accurate result we have so far. And this is the prediction of the effective theory over the data, which is, we don't have data, we use the result measured from n-body simulations. So the curve should be one. This is our theory. And you notice that this is a percent plot. So even though this is astrophysics, this is, thanks, Kendrick, this is a percent plot. And notice that, and the idea is to achieve one for as much as possible. You see that we achieve one all the way up to about 0.6%, k equal 0.6 h inverse megaparsec, which is when the theory at this scale fails. Now, the important thing is that former analytic techniques were failing at about 0.1, and that's where the data from surveys actually stopped being analyzed. So there's a factor of six improvement in our analytic control of the theory, and if you naively, this is naive, but just to get the idea, if you naively rescale this by the number of modes, 6 cubed is 200, means that there is a factor of 200 more modes in large structure surface than previously believed. And this is huge because this is making the experiment 200 times more powerful, not just plus 200, times 200. So this completely changed what we can do in the next experiment. In fact, if you take the current constraints over Fresnel equilatera and you simply, from Planck, you simply scale with this factor of 200 the forecast done for large structure surveys, that's what we can achieve in the next 10 years. So you should look at the dot, which is to scale. So improving the limits to this level is crossing some threshold, okay, because it's a big thing, okay. This
is 200 to the square root because.
Yes, but already they were doing a bit better. Yeah, it's about, so anyway, the limit is 70, now this is one half. So it's a factor of 140 better than pre-Willips limit in FNL. So this is big, if you can do it. In fact, if this holds, that is, if all observable, all quantities, if you really can do this factor of 200, that what I showed was just an observable. Okay, we need to do the full observables. If this holds, this is a revolution of what we can do in next in the next 10 years. It's something that tells us that in 10 years there could be a major improvement in our knowledge of the early universe. Okay. Okay, so this is what we're gonna achieve with this effective theory potentially. So let me construct the effective theory. Now, on very short distances, the universe is described by dark matter particles for the purpose of this talk, which are, each one is labeled by Q1, Q2, Qn, so and is a position Z or Q, and they evolve under gravity, so they are accelerated by Newton force. Because of Newton force, they cluster, and there is an overdensity proportional to how much at position X, how many particles, sum over all the particles that ended up at position X, so sum over Q1, Qn, Qn, that ended up at position X. When they cluster, the source gravity through Poisson equation, Newton equation. However, these equations that we're trying to solve are wrong because we are not trying to solve exactly the equations for dark matter in the current universe because we are never going to achieve analytic control on scales smaller than a nonlinear scale, on the scale of the galaxy cluster. There is no way we can do that. Therefore, we are never going to probe distances shorter than the nonlinear scale of the current universe, which is about 10 megaparsecs. 10 megaparsecs for us is a high energy scale, is the strongly coupled scale. But this means that the particles I'm trying to solve for cannot have, it's unfair to assume their point. Like, I should assume that they're objects of size of order 10 megaparsecs because this is the scale, which for me is a pixel. Therefore, when these objects move, they don't move like point-like particles, they move like a standard object. If you take how an standard object moves under gravity, its center of mass doesn't follow only the gravitational field on the center of mass, but there is also the effect of dental forces, which feel about the quadrupole. If there is more mass on the right or on the left, you get a different motion. So this is the forces where the question we should try to solve. Similarly, how these objects source gravity? When they move these objects, they will cluster, so there will be an overdensity or number density, but also each particle carries a quadrupole, very much like the dielectric material, each atom carries a dipole. So there will be a concentration of dipole, a quadrupole density, an octuple density, or whatever, which is the sum of the octuple of particles, or quadrupoles of particles, or that ended up at position X. This sources gravity. That is, how much gravity is being sourced is by the total energy, which is how many of these particles are with the overall mass, but also how much quadrupolar energy is there, which is the deformation of the tidal tensor. So you have to include the tidal tensor deformation, the quadrupole deformation, and the same for octuples, so all these terms. This is the effective matter density that sources gravity. This is if you remember, in electrostatic material, if you take a dipole and the charge with a dipole in an electrostatic field, its energy is the charge times the potential energy plus the dipole dot the electric field. So even the dipole carries energy. So this is the exact gravitational analogy of that. In fact, these equations are really assumptionless equations that you can derive just by guess. However, if just as a check, one can take the point-like equation that I described before and smooth them out to some cutoff scale, and see that these kind of terms are all generated by the smoothing. This is a check that if you were to change the cutoff of the theory, this term appear. This means that these terms are really already generated by some running. So these terms must be there, no matter what. These equations now have this quadrupole of X, so how do we solve for these equations? Well, we do like we did for the electric materials. That is, even the electric materials, there is a dipole of X. And what we did? We said, the dipole of X is the intrinsic dipole, which is the same for every material, everyone in the material, plus the induced response from the electric field, which is called polarizability. Here we do the same. The quadrupole of an object will be its intrinsic dipole, which by units will be some length square. and the length square is about 10 megaparsec for us, times delta ij, because it cannot be anything else. But there will be the analogous of this, the polarizability, which is how much there is induced quadrupole from a long wavelength field, which is which in our case there will be induced tidal force, tidal quadrupole induced by what the field feels, which is the second derivative of the Newton force, of the potential, because by general relativity, phi and graph phi cannot play any role because these are just gauge modes. The curvature is what sources field dynamics, so the quadrupole must be proportional to the second derivative of the field. And plus there is of the gravitational field, plus there are some stochastic terms that account for the fact that the response you get on average is not the response you get on every realization. So once you do this, this Qij of x and t, this quadrupole of x and t, is just some function of x times delta j plus another function of t times another function of t times the field of x. That is x dependent has been all transferred to the x fields. So once you plug back in the former equation this Q of x, you get that the Laplacian of phi is equal to delta plus this higher divergence of the quadrupole, which is itself a function of delta. So the resulting equation now don't contain only long wavelength fields. Short modes have disappeared from the equations. This is what in quantum field is called integrating out short distance modes. It's nothing but this. You solve the equation of motion three symbolically and plug them back. It's not fancy. But these are equations only with the long wavelength fields, so all perturbations are small. But the equations we have are different than the equation we started with. That is, we have to solve different equations than what we naively had. This is the phenomenon that as you change the energy scale, the physics it changes. This is emergent physics. It's not only a quantum phenomenon, it's also classical.
Is L0 to L1, those are going to be input into the theory?
Yes, these are called, you're asking about L0. Yeah, these are called coupling constants.
So they're arbitrary functions of time?
Yes. Yeah, now, in the universe, time translation is broken, so you're stuck with function of times. Now, there are approximate symmetry, for example, if the scaling universe, there are some approximate symmetries that can give you some guidance. In principle, they are functional time. In fact, they're even more tricky because they're actually integrals of time. That is, this effective theory is a very peculiar effective field theory because when you integrate out short distance modes, we usually obtain a local in space and time quantum field theory if there is an hierarchy of scales between the scales we care and the scales we're integrating out. Now, in space.
Just make sure I understood the previous slide. The equations are still linear at this order.
Do the same. This is the Newton Poisson equation. If you do for the. For example, here there will be also nonlinear terms. But then I just wrote the Poisson equation. We do also for the. The Newton equation. Then you do it also for the Poisson equation, for the momentum equation, and that's already nonlinear.
I see.
Okay. So discounted terms in principle are nonlinear function, but there is since these are the long modes, these are small, so you can tell or expand. So the quadratic term is smaller than okay. So to get a local in space and time effective theory, you need an hierarchy of scales. Now in space, the universe is much longer than a galaxy. So when we integrate out galaxies, we're gonna get a local in space effective theory. But in times, we would need that the time scale of galaxy is much faster than the time scale of the long modes, which is Hubble. And this is not the case. If you ask how long time takes for two galaxies to go around the cluster, is about an Hubble time. So the time scale of the short distance physics is the same time scale as the long modes we're trying to describe, which is the universe. And so the effective theory that we're gonna get is local in space, but not local in time. So this means that those terms are really integrals of time, convolution integrals of time. Now, this is a peculiar thing in effective theory, but it's written very small because technically the structure of the equation is such that we can easily deal with this non-locality in time. So even though this is a fascinating field theory effect, it doesn't have much consequences in the actual solution to the equation, so I will ignore this issue for the rest of the talk. It really has practically very little consequences. Now, Now, I still didn't explain exactly when how to solve this equation, because we know that we have the quadruple, octuple, and we substitute back for the what these objects are in terms of the long wavelength fields. But when do we stop? For example, for the electric materials, there was a dipole, but they never told you, but there could be also an electric quadruple of the atoms, which also sources some polarizability. We never put it, but you could put it in principle. So short distance physics is taking account by the expectation value, response, and noises of these effects, of these octuples, multiples. Now, in our case, we could add also the quadruple, the octuple in the Poisson equation, so on and so forth. But this expansion breaks down when the leading term, which is the number density, becomes of order of the energy induced by the deformation of the quadruple. Because when this is the case, also the deformation of the octuple maybe is the same order, and so on and so forth. In fact, you can see that by the mesh analysis, this has two derivatives acting on the outside. So no matter what, if you probe this operator at a certain distance scale, this will go like a k of interest square. So no matter what the intrinsic size of this guy is, by cranking up k, this term will be more important than this. So there is a threshold k, which we call k nonlinear. For k bigger than k nonlinear, this is bigger than this, and so the octuple and so sextuple is more important. So on that side, the stellar expansion breaks down. But also this also tells that for k much less than k nonlinear, this is smaller than this, and so on and so forth. So this tells that if you are k have k much less than k nonlinear, this is a small perturbation than this, and so you can work at a given order in k over k nonlinear and truncate the series. Each order in the series corresponds to a certain order of precision we want to achieve in k over k nonlinear. So the fading theory therefore becomes a simple expansion in k over k nonlinear, which is lambda photons over lambda atom.
So lattice. Sorry, another question. So you said these are nonlinear in time. So in fact, the question.
Non local in time.
Non local in time. So when you said delta NL is di dj of qij, that's in fact not qij at the same time.
No. The qij, yes. The qij are at the same time. What it should have been is that when I write the response, this one should have been how qij of t depends on the tidal force. It doesn't depend on the tidal force now or only, but also on the earlier time, so this should be an integral. But the structure of the equations, this is actually, for example, in one loop, this is identical to this. Okay, it just corresponds to the definition of this, which anyway we have to measure anyway, so we can just live with that. And this kind of technical tricks allows us to deal with that.
At the linear level, phi is constant.
Exactly. Order by order, since we're solving the equation perturbatively, the fact that the linear level is good tells you that at all orders is quite good. Okay, that's the idea. Okay. Why this is consistent?
So you might say, well, look, you're trying to probe things that are kind of distributions of matter within galaxies, but then I expect local physics, which I expect to vary between galaxies, to be at least as important as this.
Yeah, in fact, I'm going to do it on distances much longer than the galaxy scale, right? This object is of the intrinsic of the size of the galaxies, or cluster for us is the same thing. I'm going to take long wavelength much longer than the galaxies. That is, this is an expansion in k over k galaxies, much less than one.
If I understand you correctly, you're saying to get increased precision, we need to take in these small corrections.
Yes, but they're quite small. They are powers of k over k nonlinear.
Yeah, but so I'm just saying, at least naively, there are other things which are at least the same size as what you're talking about.
Like what?
So just distribution, how a particular galaxy is formed.
It affects. Exactly.
I'm talking about material.
Exactly. Decoupling tells you that we don't care of the detail. Whatever enters into the galaxy formation physics, it's only going to change these parameters. That is, if you have one galaxy model and another galaxy model, it is.
So galaxy by galaxy.
Sure. This is the stochastic term. That is, first of all, if you have a tidal force, galaxies say will be brighter. So this means that. But you can ask, how much is the resistance to compression of galaxies? How much they will be brighter? So all the model dependence will be into this coefficient here.
Okay.
to this response. It's true that there is some intrinsic stochasticity in galaxy formation, and these are the stochastic terms here, which, however, they average, as you go to long distances, they average very quickly to zero, because as you take your wavelength, there are many, many galaxies, you're taking average over the galaxy. No, I think this is, okay. So this stochastic term goes like this, intrinsic variation terms, by momentum and matter conservation goes down to any, like k to the fourth. This was shown by Peebles. So when number to the fourth. These terms are much more important than this because it's an expansion in k over k nonlinear. These terms that you're mentioning goes down like k over k nonlinear to the fourth power because this stochasticity anyway conserve mass and momentum. And these terms goes like k to the one. So they're much bigger. Maybe this becomes clear in the talk. So this is the whole point. Okay, this is the whole point. We don't care about short distance physics too much at all. Okay, so this is an expansion k over k nonlinear. Each term contributes a certain order, and so we just put the ones we care at a certain order k over k nonlinear.
Is it manifestly convergent? Is it actually convergent?
Well, in the sense of the asymptotic series. So every time I get this question by field theory people, the level of this field before this was that any loop was as bad as the Feynman one, and people keep computing loops. So I want to give the message that the next order calculation should be better than the Feynman one. Okay. Then we all know that QAD is not convergent, but we would be great to be at this level. Okay, it would be great to have this kind of subtleties to talk about.
It's an actual expansion rather than the other case.
Yeah, it's an asymptotic series. But I don't. But let's not scare people, okay? So now let's think a bit better what is really the expansion parameter of these theories. Now, so far I described the particle at a certain location. Now these particles are a bit extended, like bony coins that are traveling in space. And I never said how much they travel, they displace from the initial location. But we can tell the imagine that this is the displacement with respect to the initial location. And in our universe, the displacements are not that big. So one can even expand in how much the particle, a certain particle displaced from the initial conditions. This corresponds to an expansion, since this displacement has units, is an expansion in wave number all times the displacements. For the purpose of this talk, I'm going to expand in this parameter. In particular, if you look at the terms, we are going to have two effects. Three parameters around which we're expanding. This is the effect of the short displacements, the effect of the long displacement on a given mode, the effect of the short displacement on a given mode, and the effect of the tidal forces on a given mode. Let me give you some intuition for these modes. Now, take a mode, and imagine that you want to Taylor expand in respect to the location, the displacement the mode has as a function of time. This means that you are observing basically what happens from a given coordinate place as time goes on, as the matter goes on, and you ask what is delta over rho at this location x as time goes on. Now imagine that to this short mode, I add a very long mode, so long that the leading effect is just the graduate of the potential. Phi doesn't play any role, grad phi will be the leading effect. Then under time evolution, this is a force by Newton, grad phi is force. So after some time, the mode will be translated. But in the long wavelength limit, this force is constant. So all modes are translated, all positions are translated in the same way. So this mode is not deformed, it's simply translated. However, if I had to tell you responding how much a mode changes, when I go from here to here, I ask, what is delta over rho? Here is one, here is zero. So it's changed by 100% due to another mode. So it's a nonlinear effect because it's a mode effect. So this naively looks like a brachial perturbation theory because it's a nonlinear effect, which gives a 100% effect. However, this effect is trivial because it simply changed the location of the mode. It didn't deform the mode. In fact, in fancy language, it is a gauge mode, grad phi. So it's just a gauge transformation. You just keep track of where the mode was, and you just you can deal with it. So I'm going to tele-respond for explanation of this, but this you can in principle not tele-respond. Now, another parameter is, imagine that you have your same mode, and on top of this, you had a very short mode. This mode will displace the particle on short distances like this. And then under time evolution, the particle displays and the log mode is deformed. This is a dynamical effect. If you change the particle location on short distances, you change the shape of the mode. So short modes, the displacement induced by the short modes is a dynamical effect. And similarly, imagine that you have your mode and you put a comparable wavelength mode, which is comparable wavelength, so you're sensitive also to the Laplacian of phi. Laplacian of phi is the curvature. So it's important. It will, under time evolution, you will contract the mode. So under time evolution, this mode is deformed. So this is another dynamical effect. And the dynamical effect, there is no way to deal with than stellar expanding. And the first one was also a kinematical effect. Now, I'm going to expand in all three of them, just for simplicity. If I expand in all three of them, the equations that I obtained for the system are nothing but a Navier-Stokes system, where, however, the fact that there is a short distance physics shows in the fact that there is an induced stress tensor on the long wavelength fields. The stress tensor, I write it like the quadruple, I write in terms of the long wavelength fields, and the generic form is this. So there is some zero order pressure, some speed of sound, and so on and so forth. So we're going to try to solve this system.
Sorry, shouldn't there be like second derivatives of potential there as well?
Second, like Laplacian of phi, what do you mean?
In tau ij, yeah. Like di dj phi. Mm.
But Poisson equation, Laplacian of phi is equal to delta rho. So
yeah,
it's this.
No, the after diagonal part is.
Yeah, at linear level, it doesn't contribute by rotation invariance because you need to contract it. But it is at nonlinear level. So you put all the ones which are allowed by symmetries.
Okay.
And then you do some bookkeeping to find which are relevant at a given order. But, okay, it's there.
I thought that was the whole point of having quadruple as a thing, a couple.
Quadruple. So basically, contributes like here, like dIdj of dIdj phi, which is called Laplacian square of phi, which is equal to Laplacian of delta.
No, I mean, tau ij is a tensor, right? So there could be.
Sorry, I apologize.
Yeah.
Here I should have written, forget this. Yeah, fine.
So there could be.
No, sorry, there should be.
Term.
Yes, but sorry, this is a typo, because what matters then is dIdj. This equation is a bit wrong, so I have a typo. So what matters is the IDJ or tau IJ, which goes like then this pressure is zero, this one is zero, and this one will look like C square D2 phi, D2 delta. If you have also your friend, the IDJ phi, you will get the IDJ of the IDJ phi, which is D2 square of phi, which is actually degenerate with this one. Okay, by Poisson equation. So fine, thanks, this is a type of that equation. But it is there, okay. Now, for simplicity, let's work in this approach where there is this Euler equation, which are Navier-Stokes-like equation. They're not quite so because they are, it's asymptotic, it's non-linear, not local in time, the counter-terms, but doesn't matter. So let's do perturbation theory with this effective theory. But first of all, let me show you a non-renormalization theorem. That is, remember that some years ago, people was wondering if short-distance nonlinearities can back-react on the universe and give you a big acceleration of the universe, even in the absence of dark energy. This approach proves that this is impossible. In fact, if you take the tau j induced by short-distance physics, and even before taking the expectation value, you look at it as written in terms of the short modes, you find that at long distance, the short modes renormalize the effective stress tensor of the long modes, in a way that's such that the energy density of the long modes is the energy density of the short plus the kinetic energy of the short plus the potential energy of the short. Very simple physics, very intuitive. A galaxy going around should look like a point particle with a mass given by the sum of the energies. But the pressure of a given mode, the pressure on the long wavelength physics is, there is a pressure induced by the short modes, which is twice the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. Now, in our universe, this v and phi are always 10 to the minus 5 everywhere, but rho can be 10 to the 20. So this could be 10 to the 15, and this also can be 10 to the plus 15. So in principle, you can get a huge break reaction, because if p is minus rho, you're done. You don't get any dark energy. But if you remember, undergraduate, this combination, 2 times the kinetic energy plus the potential energy, is the combination that for the realized system is 0. So it tells you that as soon as modes virialize, short distance modes don't contribute anymore to the induced pressure. This is a this tells you, first of all, there cannot be back reaction. But notice that for the quantum field theory aficionados, this is a normalization theorem, because the fact that the short distance physics affect one parameter of the Lagrange is what is called decoupling. Short distance physics simply affect some parameter of the Lagrange. But when they don't affect it at all, most short and differentiation scale don't affect it at all, this is another renormalization theorem. It's like in SUSY, loops vanish after above the SUSY scale. Now, but for our purpose, it tells you that these terms cancels, and so the induced pressure is very small. In particular, it is of the order of when these terms as large as possible without having been realized yet. So it's about the modes of the nonlinear scale, where rho is 1, and delta rho is 1, and v and phi is 10 to the minus 5. So an induced universe with the metal clustering has a bit of pressure, which is 10 to minus 5 rho. So W effect is 10 to minus 5 rho. But this also tells that people who say it's back reaction, they find a big contribution perturbation theory, because there are visualizations of non-perturbative effect. So you will never see it in perturbation theory. So they will compute forever and always get large back reactions. But ultimately, it will all cancel. It's I think in the limit it's called I think you can form the no-hair theorem, but I think it's just the viralization theorem. Yeah, I mean any central force. I mean it's very general, the viralization, right? Any central force. In fact, we proved that it works at all order in post-Newtonian expansion. Okay, so but most important, we want to do a perturbation theory with this theory. So we want to solve perturbative equation where we replace the tau j with the long wavelength modes. How do we do perturbation theory? Well, let's take the same loops that people did for many years, and let's evaluate them with the cutoff. Then you will get the one loop expression will be some k over k nonlinear times the linear power spectrum times some cutoff lambda square. Then the terms with one more k and one less lambda just by dimensional analysis. So these are divergent terms. Then you get logarithms. Then you get terms which are really finite because they were just the Taylor expansion of this expression. And then even more finite terms. Now you see that if I just do these loops are well ill-defined because there is a cutoff here. So the result depends on the cutoff and in principle is huge. So this is bad. But in fact, some of these terms vanish. And they vanish because the fact that the result is large and depends on the cutoff means that my result is dominated by the short distance physics in these loops. But the short distance physics, I'm not controlling it. So whatever I'm getting is going to be wrong because I wasn't controlling it. So, but in this effective theory, we have the stress tensor, which was taking account of how the short distance physics effectively back react at long distances. And so it should be able, the stress tensor, the parameter of the stress tensor, to cancel whatever thing I get wrong from my perturbation theory and to add the right result. Now, these terms don't have the functional form to be canceled by the stress tensor. And in fact, when you do the calculation, even though they are allowed by dimensional analysis, they're not there. However, this term is there, and this term is as dangerous, this is divergent. But when you plug the speed of sound into the power spectrum, you find that this speed of sound contributes in the power spectrum with a functional form which is exactly the same as this. So you can choose this CS, which I call C counter terms, to cancel whatever I get from here and to add something finite so that the sum of the one loop expression plus the counter terms is some finite number times k over k nonlinear square. And this is small. This is smaller than the linear terms, but k over k nonlinear, which is a very small number, plus all the finite terms that are small. So you see that this is, by the way, this is what is called renormalization. It's nothing to do with quantum field theory. It's as simple as this. But it tells you that you get a small result order by order in perturbation theory only after renormalization. If you don't do renormalization, each order in perturbation theory is bigger than the former one. Very bad, naively. Now, so in this field, renormalization is not very well appreciated. So let me just give you some more comments about this, because you might think, since we have this coupling constant, everything, all predictivity has been lost. Let me show you that indeed effective theory are still predictive. Now you can see that these terms I had to add by hand to subtract the divergences. So this term is not predicted by the theory. It's a number that must be fitted to observations. But you see that it comes with a precise functional form. I cannot tweak the functional form. So It's the coefficient, in a sense, I can marginalize over the functional form if I don't like it. This term is instead sk cube here, and there is no counter term that has this form. So this term is untouchable by my counter terms. So this number here, nobody can touch it. And for example, for some symmetric universe, it would be 0.044, and you should go to observation and find 0.044 independent of what the counter terms here. So these are so-called calculable terms in the FET theory. It are the so-called non-analytic terms in field theories. For the aficionados, again, in relativistic quantum field theory, these are the coefficients of the logs, which are the only part which is non-analytic in the answer. And these are called the beta functions, the coefficients of the logs. This is a non-relativistic effective field theory, so we have many more non-analytic terms. So in a sense, it's even more predictive. So even better.
Where is the log
here? Log just means non-analyticity. Exactly, it's a non-analytic term, and so the coefficient is predicted. So the terms that are predicted in the FET theory.
The K cube looks analytic.
Ah, sorry. No, it will be the square root of K to the 6. And square root you cannot write because of it's a non-analytic.
This K is a vector. All right, this K has to be
in. Yeah. Thanks.
So if you want to apply this to data analysis, you would treat this coefficient.
Yeah, exactly. Now, it's like a coupling constant, right? I mean, exactly. Now, notice that after you do the normalization, at every loop, K over K nonlinear goes like the loop contributes like K over K nonlinear to the L, so it's smaller and smaller as you go. But notice that if you didn't do the normalization, that is, even if you didn't have the counter terms, you get lambda over K nonlinear to the L. So each loop contributes the same. You do loops, and you get the same, as wrong, never improve. But after the normalization, you are better. Every order is better. Now, it does not that up to two loops, we only need one counter terms for technical reason. And so keep in mind that all the results I'm gonna show have only one counter terms. In fact, I think another physical comment is that there is also the contribution of infrared mode. Remember, as I said before, there are long wavelength modes displace the short wavelength fields, and if they displace the fields by a lot, you have a trivial nonlinear effect, which is just a kinematical. Since this is a kinematical effect, we can just resum it. And again, the effect is this: under a long wavelength mode, a short mode gets translated, and if you Taylor expand in the location of a mode, you will get a fake nonlinear effect. And now. For a local observable, the way to resum it is the following. This mode is just the gradient of a scalar field. So it just you can remove it by a change of coordinates because it's not a curvature. The grad of phi, you can put it to zero by change of coordinate. So this corresponds to go to the local inertial frame of the long mode. So when you go to the local inertial frame of the long modes, a field will transform like the change of coordinates plus when it's a vector also gets, where it's not a scalar, it also gets a shift. This tells that so there is a shift and also the shift in the field. And for fields that are scalar, that is for field that this term is absence, this naively implies by general relativity that there are no infrared effects in equal time correlators. Because if I do the power spectrum of delta rho over rho, when I go to the local inertial frames, both modes and I evaluate the terms at the same time, both modes are shifted by the same amount, and so it cancels when I do the average. But in reality, the situation is a bit, but for non-scalar, this is not the case. This means that some quantities are called IR safe. But this is a bit of an illusion, because in the current universe, there are many scales in the problem. The power spectra are a bit non-trivial. In particular, if you look at the real space correlation function, there's a peak here, a 100 megaparsec, well in the linear regime, which is called the BAO peak, which is extremely important for dark energy surveys. And now, even this means that you see that if you want to predict, this is a very sharp peak. So this is a real space, so it's a very sharp peak. So the width of this peak is controlled by short wavelength perturbations, which are very nonlinear. But so for them, the effect of long modes is important. But we want, could be in principle important, and we think that it cancels by the symmetry argument, but it cannot cancel modes of order the scale of the peak, which is about 100 megaparsec, cannot cancel from the answer because we're looking at correlation function exactly of 100 megaparsec. So there is no inertial frame for those modes because they're too long. So displacements induced by 100 megahertz and modes affect a lot, non-perturbatively, the evolution of this peak. And that's why the width of this peak, that's why this must be treated non-perturbatively to get the peak right. And this, we did it. And I will not spare you the formula. Let me just show you the results of this effective theory. So this effective theory in one loop and then two loop. Since each loop goes like ever canonlinear to the L, each loop should be better than the former one. And you see it does. Better means that it's one for longer time because, for example, the two loop is scalar canonlinear square, so it was negligible here, and the one loop, in fact, was already good. Then the one loop becomes bad when the two loop becomes important. And then the two loop should fail when the three loop becomes important. We didn't compute the three loop, but by estimating how when this theory fails, you can estimate what is canonlinear, and you can plot the estimated three loop term. So this theory should fail when the estimate for the three loop term becomes important because the three loop is non-zero. And indeed, you see that the theory fails more or less when the free loop term is becomes important. So this theory, order by order, improves. And you know, you can estimate when the next order should fail, and it fails when it should. So we know when it fails, and it fails when it should. The dotted lines are the results obtained by without infrared summation. In the power spectrum, the BAO peak, since you are an expert, the BAO peaks are the oscillations of the power spectrum. The fact that in the PFT over P nonlinear, our P theory over P nonlinear, I was getting some wiggle in the ratio means that I was getting wrong these oscillations, which means that in real space I was getting wrong the BAO peak. This is because the IR summation is very important. And you can see that from one loop to two loop, it was not improving. The ratios, the oscillations were always the same size. As you get the infrared summation, the oscillations are gone, which means that in real space, the BAO peak is right. This is the p-nonlinear data. In fact, for p-nonlinear, since I wasn't able yet to convince anybody, now I convinced somebody, but for most of the time, we were not able to convince anybody doing a body simulation that it was interesting. I was doing this Coyote emulator, and there's a feature there. For p-nonlinear, our p-nonlinear are p-coyote emulator, which is an average of embodied simulation.
This is when the Kay simulation switch resolution or something.
Yeah, I didn't care. Yeah. I just saw that there is a feature there. Not yet, it's okay because they say there is 1% error bar and this 1%. In fact, in most of this field, you always see log plots. Here we're doing 1%, but I'm not just showing off. It's true that our understanding of Lachaise structure here most of the time is at the level of log plots. But if we want to do early universe with Lachaise structures, we have to beat Planck. We have to get better than Planck. Otherwise, who cares? And Planck gives us percent plots. So the only way to go is to get percent plots for these fields. So this is a percent. That's why this feature. Nobody saw this feature otherwise.
I guess the question is how many parameters you have to fit?
One parameter.
For all of this, just one parameter.
And beyond. So the fact that we fit until 0.6 means that there is this factors of 200 quadrilinear modes, more than previously believed, which is huge. And also, let me compare to the former techniques. So this is the effective theory with infrared summation at three level, one loop, two loop, and you see that every order improves as it should. And this is what former techniques were doing. This is three level former technique. This is one loop former technique. This is two loop former technique. They were never improving. In fact, people even computed three loop former technique. I don't know why, but so that's why when I mean this manifestly convergent, and try to this I think is much better. Okay, there is a very nice consistency check of this theory, but let me just mention it. When we do the effective theory, the two loop term, for example, is the standard is the same term that we used in the standard techniques, but we have to add counter terms. The counter terms are a bunch of terms, which however are a known function of this parameter that we measured in one loop. So can I have another 5 minutes? So it's the same parameter that we measure. So we measure this CS parameter in one loop. And then this curve is totally predicted. And it's the sum of this term, which you see is huge, plus the predicted counter terms. And the predicted counter terms, so therefore, have to do the job of canceling this big effect. So they must be big. And they cancel it to 2% precision for some time until stop canceling when the theory should fail. So this, I think, is a remarkable check of the theory because it tells you that these terms are really non-trivial, and this is quite remarkable. Okay, this is the BO peak that we got it right after the infrared summation, and it takes only 5 minutes to get it because it's just the infrared summation. Okay, now these parameters that we are measuring from the power spectra of the correlation function, in principle, are we could measure in embodied simulation because they are controlled by the ultraviolet physics. But ultraviolet physics here is known, is the metal particle going around under gravity. So you could take a small box of embodied simulation and measure this parameter and feed them to me in effective theory. Then this parameter is no more a free parameter, it's a known parameter in the limit in which the embodied simulation are exact of the universe. This is what we did initially, and this is not a great result. It's a fantastic result, but it has bigger error bars because it was done by me and string theorist, because again, we couldn't convince anybody doing it. So me and a string theorist took an embodied simulation, which we didn't know what it was. Okay. But we measure, this is very similar to what happens in lattice QCD. A low energy QCD looks like the Carrot-Lagrangian, and there is a parameter called f pi. This was measured by the 60 in pi scattering. But later, f pi could be measured by looking at quark, anti-quark correlation function. You measure f pi in lattice QCD, and the two results agree. So we're doing basically the same here. We took a box, we smoothed, and we measure some quantity that should be the speed of sound. But this is dark matter 1, dark matter 2, gravitational energy, its velocity. So it's written in terms of the fundamental degrees of freedom. And we get this result here. And then as we change the smoothing, we get this result here. So you see that this speed of sound is different in the two measurements. This is different because when we take this speed of sound, we sum over some particle within a certain box size of lambda. Now, if you give this number to the effective theory, to predict the result, the effective theory should have a cutoff which is equal to lambda. Now, if I measure in the box with a different lambda, I should do the effective theory with a different cutoff lambda. So this change should be how much the prediction of the effective theory, how much the loop changes as you change the cutoff from lambda 1, lambda 2. So the change between here and here is predicted. And in fact, this curve is the prediction of the running of the speed of sound as you change the cutoff of the theory. This is called lattice running. Lattice people know it, but it happens the same. You see how well it works. The parameter that you get in the long distance theory is the limit of lambda goes to infinity. So this number here is what we get from this embodied measurement. And this is what we get if you fit directly with the observation. I would claim it's very good. In fact, it's so good that if you're new QCD, you would just stop here and say, okay, this is right. However, okay, it's very technical, so.
Do you have a sense that this is to
variable processes? Yeah, I have a slide on this, exactly. We're doing this now. Now, okay, so you see it's very complicated, okay, very complicated. Okay, let me mention other observables. Now, another observable is not only dark matter correlation function, but also momentum correlation function, how much particle go. And you should look at this blue line. We did the one loop result, and it fails at 0.3, which is more or less the one loop, when the one loop here was failing more or less at 0.3. So the momentum power spectrum fails at a given order when the power spectrum dark matter fails. So each order seems to fail at the same level, which is good because every observable should fail at the same order, at the same k-max if you do the calculation at the same order. Also the three-point function we computed, and this three-point function is not just a line, it's a function of two variables, so very, very complex, and it fails again at 0.3. Without any additional parameters, so the same parameters that was fixed in the power spectrum of dark matter controls also the one loop by spectrum and the one loop power spectrum, and they all agree. And now, we didn't compare yet for the bias energy space distortion, even though the formula we just worked out. Another prediction of this effective theory was the vorticity, which is a nice field theory example. That is, take the vorticity, the velocity field of dark matter can be defined as the ratio of the momentum over the density. And you can see that this definition is a bit tricky because defies fields at the same location. Device fields at the same location. So it's very sensitive to short modes. So this definition is in quantum theory is called the contact operator. And needs to be, this means that when you define the things at the same location, you don't know what you're doing, and you need to add the counter terms to correct for the mistake you did. So we have these counter terms, and we find that both these counter terms and also the vorticity that we have in the stress tensor generate out of non-initial vorticity, we get vorticity. And the vorticity has these two power, this is the sum of these two slopes, k square and k cube. And people did in the simulations. One comes from these contact terms and the other from the stress tensor of this vorticity. Because when they define this this ratio, it's really about what the people in the simulation do. Ah, do I put it on the grid on the left or on the grid on the left? So it's a different thing because it's about the definition of the field, not about the physics. So, and then when people measure in simulations, and you see now we're back to log-log plots, okay, because it's simulations. Anyway, this kind of slope, which is about 2.5, which is exactly the sum of these two. So it looks pretty good. And also it tells you that the former approach could never, there's a theorem that tells you, even if you solve them on two order, you will never obtain vorticity. So this is the end of all the other approaches. In fact, if you have questions about the other approaches, please ask me later, because I'm very, very strong with the other approaches. I'm happy to justify more in detail. To answer Kendrick's questions, what about baryons? Now, the logic that gives rise to the Fetti theory for the dark matter was that this dark matter doesn't move much around. Two dark matter particles and light don't move much around within a galaxy, within 10 megaparsec. So we could consider long-distance physics as made of large extended objects. But even baryons they don't move much. There are explosions, blah, stars red, stars blue, blah, blah, but they don't move it. So the same logic applies to baryons, which, however, notice that we cannot even be simulated by first principle. Nobody's claiming that. But this tells you that there will be a parameter also. The baryons can be described as a fluid of extended objects, a continuum of extended objects with some parameter. And now we are this parameter predicts a shape, k square p1 1, to the correction to two baryons, and these are our theory lines. And these are the data. So you're cutting me off because, yeah, I see this is the last slide, okay? Okay, maybe I can just stop. It was the last slide. Okay.
Very famous astrophysicist.
Yeah, sorry, this is my frustration slide. Sorry, Henry, can you help? I lost it. I don't know what is Acrobat anymore.
Maybe it was table. Don't touch it, don't touch it.
No. Ah, okay. But now it doesn't. Where is Acrobat?
Up and down. I send the other in the.
Ah, okay. Up and down. Okay, the baryons, you see, this is the functional form we predict, and these are the data. You see, the functional forms works very well until when the theory should fail, which is about 0.6, because we predict when it fails. And these are the different astrophysical models. All the astrophysics that you put in, this should answer again your question, changes the coefficients of this of the effective theory. It doesn't change the functional form. And you see that this works.
So when you say data there, you mean different models?
Yeah, they put active galactic nuclei, supernova.
Different models.
Yeah, and these are called models. They don't even think it's a theory, but yes, exactly. So, but this tells you that you can make your own judgment about this. Okay, the fact that it works tells you that maybe if it works everything in the same level, we can get FNL less than 1. And this is really a huge improvement in the theoretical threshold. I'm not saying that this is done, but this tells us that if the fact that this quantity holds tells us that there is a gold mine potentially at the end. Now, something else must fail, so we might not get there. But this tells you that it's worth working on this, because if you can get this, it's a big thing. We're not working for nothing. If this failed here, we could just do something else. Okay, so instead, no. There is potentially something more to do. You can get to this. Okay, let me just conclude by saying that I think overall this is a nice field theory. In fact, you can see the most, if not all, of the features of quantum field theory appear in this effective theory of large structure, which is a classical system, which happens to be also true in the universe. Loops, divergences, counterterms, renormalization all appeared. Non-renormalization theorems, calculable and non-calculable terms like the logs appeared. Measurements in lattice and lattice running and matching all appear. IR divergences also. So everything things on Peskin book, on my book, you kind of find it. To me, what is more important is that the results seems to be amazing, even though many calculations verification still to do. It's like the situation that LHC was turning on and we just learned how to do QCD. Okay, now let's look what we can do with it. For example, higher endpoint function validation with simulations. And this is now, at the beginning, I was quite alone, but now a larger group of people is coming in. And to let you know how people realized that this could be revolutionary for the field of Lattice structure immediately after our two-loop paper, which reached this 0.6 inverse megaparsec 2% precision, a workshop on this subject was organized at Princeton. So I think at Princeton, if this works, I think the 10-year future of early cosmology is in very good shape, even without being luck. If you're lucky, it's even better. Okay, thanks for the extra time.
Let's squeeze in maybe one question for Elena.
Yes?
I think you went by this quickly. Supposing you don't take your astrophysicist view of galaxy formation with AGN and stuff, but you take your cosmology theorist where you say, oh, I'm going to identify with galaxies with peaks of the density field or something simplistic like that. Does all this still follow through to, can you apply the same calculations to that?
Sorry, no, what I was showing it was not the galaxy power spectrum, was the baryon matter power spectrum.
Right, but of course we measure the spectrum of some points, which are...
Yes, when you do these are the bias. So so the similar techniques are for the bias. That is, you have to put the bias coefficients with all the symmetry terms allowed, and the bias terms are also get normalized at a given order in perturbation theory, you have to do the normalization. So the same machinery applies to bias. The formula have been worked out. So what you mentioned is the galaxy bias, and your recipe was a particular way to get the galaxy bias, which will be accurate to some level. And particularly was the halo bias, and you were assuming that the galaxies form in the halos. So this, the formula been worked out, we are working towards comparing them with data. The check has not been done, but the claim is that it should work as well. But there will be new parameters now, which is called the bias coefficients, which are non-predicted by the theory. Some theories will have some models for it. We can give them some prior. But by putting all the bias coefficient right and doing the calculation right, that is also doing renormalizations, and counting the relevant counter terms, we should be able to achieve this. So to connect to observations, we should do this, and also ratio space distortion, which again, the formula has been worked out, but not compared with the data. It's a bit a long path, but if people want to help, we'll help more quickly. But these are the comparison with simulation, which give a sense of the scale of the problem, of the scale. So if these plots were failing at 0.1, we knew that you couldn't do better than 0.1. Now we can get to 0.6, which is a huge difference. And let's see if it stays. Thanks.
Has that been all right then?